Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver and this is the show that looks at business and politics from a wider perspective. Coming up on the show today, where has Elon Musk gone since tariffs came to town? What exactly is a sovereign wealth fund? Should every country have one? Or is it simply a vanity project? Plus, what do people in Greenland really think of Donald Trump? You can, of course, email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, it's been the relationship that I really suppose has defined the presidential duration or innings so far of President Trump, Elon Musk and Donald Trump. Some people have described them as the odd couple, the toxic twins, or their blossoming bromance. But has it gone all a little bit sour? And where does Elon Musk fit in the orbit of Donald Trump at this particular point? We've seen some interesting developments over the last few days as this tariff issue has become tangled and unentangled and so on. And here to ask us where it might end and how Elon Musk fits into the universe of Donald Trump is Joe Miller, who is the Washington correspondent of the Financial Times. And he joins me now in Taking Stock. Joe, you're very welcome along.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as I said, we all want to know how this story is going to end. It probably has a few weeks, maybe even a few months, maybe even a few years to go yet. But we are intrigued to see what the final chapter will be written. We have been told a few weeks ago there was a story in Politico that Elon Musk was going to sort of fade into the background and have a lesser role in the White House as head of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, as it's called. Since then, he's been attacking some of this tariff policies on his own platform, X, and so on. Should I read into that that he is likely to be stepping back, or do you think it's a bit too early to write his Trump obituary at least?
Well, I'd be a fool to make any predictions that could go sour within minutes or hours. But there's certainly been some very interesting developments that you alluded to there, which is that, you know, as you mentioned, Musk, since spending more than $250 million on Donald Trump's campaign, has been pretty much joined at the hip with the president. He's been at his side at Mar-a-Lago and then in Washington, literally occupying an office right next to the White House and running this DOGE and having a very, very prominent role in pretty much all government policy, either, you know, in behind the scenes or vocally on X. But that's all changed over the last couple of weeks for a number of reasons, one of which is, as you mentioned, that Elon Musk does not look kindly upon tariffs. He obviously has his companies, Tesla, the car maker, which makes a lot of cars in China. He has SpaceX and Starlink, which is also exposed to tariffs. And he hasn't held back. He called Peter Navarro, who's the architect of Trump's trade policy, a moron the other day. And so this spat is out in the open. And at the same time, we've seen Musk's political influence begin to wane a little bit because he spent a lot of money on a Wisconsin Supreme Court race on backing a particular candidate. That candidate lost handsomely. And there's a lot of whispers around Washington now that Musk's days at the forefront of this regime are numbered.
Yes, and obviously the Republicans are getting nervous as well, it seems. He's a bit of a poison to their political prospects. You've mentioned this Wisconsin outcome. Also, I guess he'll be pushed a little bit by his own shareholders in these three companies, and he has a few other ones as well on top of those main three. But they might be saying, get back to work, get back to the office. I mean, do you get any sense that his own companies are saying, maybe you should just cut back on all this politics stuff?
Certainly behind the scenes, that's what they're telling me, some of his major investors. There's quite a lot of disquiet. I'm sure you've seen that the Tesla share price has been on a downward trajectory over the last few weeks and months. There have been a lot of protests against Tesla from people who are upset at Doge's policies and at Musk's support for Trump. And Starlink, which is a satellite internet provider that's part of SpaceX, has lost a lot of contracts with governments who are also disinclined to do business with someone who is that close to Trump. It's fair to say, though, that investors who invest in Musk's businesses know that there's going to be a fair amount of turbulence and he does things his own way. And so there hasn't been that much in terms of people coming out publicly and saying, go back to your businesses. But interestingly, one person who has floated that idea is Donald Trump, who said a week or two ago that he expects Musk will want to go back to his businesses.
It's kind of like someone leaving someone's house. You know, it's your time to go. I think that's your taxi outside.
Quite.
Slight elements of that. I suppose we have a bit of a track record of other people who've been in Trump's circle I wouldn't say disappeared, which sounds a bit sinister, but have kind of left the Trump circle. You know, you'd think of your Mike Pence's. We had Rex Tillerson in the first administration. There was Anthony Scaramucci, who lasted, I don't know, it was about a week or something like that, as spokesman for the White House. There's been a whole list of them. And once they're gone, they're gone. There isn't a second act. But maybe Musk might sort of, I mean, this is just a theory of my own, he might disappear but not go completely, because he's such a huge figure in the American business landscape. It would almost be difficult for the two of them to avoid each other if they were to fall out, because they're probably two of the most totemic figures in American politics or business at the moment.
I think that's exactly right. I think that those who expect clean exit by Musk are misunderstanding the dynamic here. In that, a lot of focus has been, you know, put on the fact that Musk, the world's richest man, has bankrolled Donald Trump's campaign, and that the money is important to Trump. I don't think that's true. I mean, $250 million is a lot of money to anyone, but it's still not a sum that Trump couldn't find elsewhere from other donors or at least Trump's allies. And let's not forget that at least as things stand, Trump is not running again, so he doesn't need to raise this kind of money. I think having Elon Musk around and the importance of having Elon Musk inside the camp is that he could become a bitter and very vocal opponent who has his own platform and his own megaphone, which is probably the only megaphone that can rival Donald Trump's. And it's much more convenient, to say the least, for Donald Trump to have Elon Musk, however imperfectly, as part of the administration, more or less cheerleading for him than making noises outside. And that's why I think that they'll be very reluctant to sort of kick him out in a public way. And it will probably be some form of, you know, massaged message in which we hear that he's stepping back from Doge and taking on a more advisory role or something like that, the contours of which I think will become apparent in the next few weeks.
Yeah, because based on his personality type, and remember, he's publicly on the record for saying he takes ketamine. We know he's not someone to button his lip generally. It's hard to see him just sort of disappearing politically and not saying anything about politics ever again. Just knowing the personality, and a bit like yourself, I've tracked him for a few years now, more on the business side. But it's very unlikely that he's just going to say, I'm just going to run my companies and become a boring technocratic manager. So I suspect Elon Musk, whatever else happens, he'll be saying political things for quite a while.
Yes, and it's, you know, fair to say, I think that he's become more and more of a political animal, not just since he started to back Donald Trump explicitly last summer, but over the last few years. You know, he bridled against COVID-19 restrictions. He started to hit out against Democratic lawmakers who he thought were putting up regulations that were hindering SpaceX and Tesla. And, you know, he spends a far greater proportion of his time some days posting about politics, or at least about political issues, than he does about the, you know, workings of his companies. And that used to be different a few years ago. You know, many people were familiar with him as more of an engineer and an entrepreneur who was interested in, you know, talking about going to Mars and the rest. And he still is very interested in those things, but I can't see him ever stepping back from politics at this point. I think it's either he is politically aligned with Trump or the the reverse.
Yeah, and I suppose we're trying to get a sense of where he is. If you did a little line graph, you know, where is Elon Musk at the moment? With the company, the Tesla company, slightly in decline, probably a bit stronger than that. Big rivals from China, you know, sales falling. Okay, we leave SpaceX out for the second. X has struggled to get advertising. It's had a lot of toxic content. Content moderation issues, borrowed a lot of money to get bought. So when you look at all of those together, and you did a line graph of his where he's at, you'd sort of see maybe just a bit coming down the other side of the peak. Would you agree with that description?
Certainly. I mean, if you take the last few months, you know, look at that peak to have evidence of that peak, just look at Tesla's share price and, you know, where it was a few months ago and where it is now. You know, there's nothing to say that that can't rebound. And, you know, he's defied the odds many, many, many times in several different industries and spheres. But things have become, you know, far more complicated. He's, you know, he's not just the world's wealthiest man. He's not just, you know, deeply involved in politics, but as you say there, he now has many, many more rivals. So, you know, many of his businesses were out there with their products and innovations before anyone else could get there, and now others are catching up. You know, you have Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos's space company, which is beginning to rival some of SpaceX technology, and you know, as you say, you've got these Chinese car makers who are not just rivaling Tesla's EV technology, but in many ways surpassing it, especially when it comes to batteries. And of course, you know, there are several other social media sites and platforms that some people would consider less compromising than X. And then there's AI, which Musk is into. And of course, that's a very crowded field. So, you know, it's a very different business environment for him. And that's not just because of his association with Donald Trump.
No, and let's throw it forward a little bit. We always like to do that on this program, looking at next November, as in November the year after, midterm elections. At the moment, we don't know how exactly they're going to go, but there's a good chance the Democrats do well, at least in the House of Representatives. So the Congress is a little bit more mixed then and more contested. So he might be the poster boy for the Democrats, say, look, you know, these oligarchs, people like this guy, Elon Musk, are everything to blame. You know, you can see this big tour by the Democrats, Bernie Sanders and so on at the moment. They're putting Musk posters up everywhere. So it could get worse from his point of view politically. He could just become almost too notorious and be just an endless target going into those elections next year, which is it's a good bit away. But I could see him getting dragged into that and not in a good way from the Republican Party perspective.
Yes, it's very interesting that if you look at polls at the moment, Donald Trump's popularity is waning a little bit, but still, you know, he's in the high 40s, high 40%. Musk is way, way lower. And in certain parts of the country, it's in negative territory. You know, the two, while they're aligned politically, do not enjoy the same warmth around the country among Republican voters. And we've seen evidence of this in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race I mentioned earlier, where, you know, Musk plowed $25 million into this small judicial race. His candidate lost by 10 percentage points, and the Democrats had made the entire campaign into the People versus Musk. That was the name of their campaign. And they, you know, essentially said, do you want this billionaire coming in here and telling you how to vote? And it backfired tremendously on the Republican back candidate and on Musk. And, you know, while Republican members of Congress here in Washington are always telling me, you know, off record, that they are afraid to defy Trump because Musk will use his significant war chest to back their you know, primary challenges, etc., ahead of next year's midterms, I think it's a greater, you know, threat to Republicans that Musk gets involved, as you say, than a blessing.
Yeah, there just seems to be, I don't know what it is in the air, just a feeling, maybe a sentiment that, you know, very wealthy oligarchs are out of control in the United States. And this isn't a view held only by Democrats, but some parts of the Republican base seen Steve Bannon having a go at Elon Musk and others as well. So it's sort of cross-party. So he could run into a bit of a firestorm come next year, where the last thing anyone wants around is a rich South African guy who's controls a car company in decline. He might just find that he's out of time by the time next year rolls around. So that's just maybe my wishful thinking, personal wishful thinking, but you could see those circumstances coming together into alignment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Steve Bannon there. Of course, firstly, he has probably more right to claim he has his finger on the pulse of MAGA voters than Elon Musk ever had. And he despises Musk and says so repeatedly. But also, you know, big chunks of the so-called MAGA coalition not only don't like billionaires and oligarchs, but ran on this, you know, ran against big tech, you know, said that Donald Trump was the man who would wrestle control back from, you know, left-wing billionaires in Silicon Valley, etc., from monopolists in, you know, the social media space and the rest, from, you know, Wall Street investors. And indeed, you know, during the trade war over the last few weeks, we've heard, you know, Trump and his allies lambast Wall Street and lambast, you know, traders and investors. And so I think that it's going to be a hard sell to go around and say, you know, Elon Musk is a man of the people and, you know, the person you voted for or you wanted to give more power. I don't think there are many Republican voters out there who feel that strongly about that, at least if you, you know, believe what Republican strategists tell you.
Now, Elon Musk Inc., if you can call it that, that company doesn't exist. But if he was a company, he prefers to dabble in European politics a lot of the time, very keen on what's happening in Britain. He's occasionally thrown the odd grenade into Irish politics. And of course, we've seen him talking about Germany with the AfD and so on. So I don't know, that might be the distraction away from the US, is just to look at other elections, obviously what's going on with Marianne Le Pen. So he's plenty of toy sets to play with over the next few years that aren't necessarily US, because he really does seem to think that his voice is of influence beyond stateside. So he's got a few options there to make up and do with his time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the AfD there. That was another instance of when he heavily backed the AfD, and it didn't seem to have made any difference to their result. Their result was pretty much similar to their polling before Musk came out in support. But yeah, you know, being distracted is probably the right way of putting it. We did some reporting earlier this year, which showed that you know, Elon Musk is, to quote someone in the story, radicalized by his own algorithm. And people.
Nice idea.
Yeah, well, it appears to be true. People put things into his feed on X, and X is where he gets all of his news from. And people around him tell me, you know, that is true, that he doesn't go to any other sources. And so, you know, if the various blue ticked accounts and that he follows, you know, start to talk about German politics or British politics or even Irish politics, he seizes on that without knowing very much about the details or the context, and he can very, very quickly go down a rabbit hole, you know, which is why it's anyone's guess.
I know.
What he'll be most preoccupied about.
If he was to leave public life, there's always another one lined up. His brother, Kimball Musk, who's on the board of his companies, has also been saying various things about tariffs. So maybe there's a factory in South Africa turning them out. If you don't want Elon, you have Kimball waiting in the wings. So we're going to have one Musk or the other. Listen, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for giving your perspective from Washington. That's Joe Miller, Washington correspondent of the Financial Times. We appreciate you joining us on Taking Stock today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we go to Greenland. Welcome back to Taking Stock. This is Emmett Oliver. Now, up until last week's adventures in tariff land, are they on off? Of course, China's one's still persisting, but the ones on Europe, at least some of them, have been frozen. But before all of that, a lot of the world's geopolitical attention was on Greenland and the way the United States and President Trump are eyeing up that particular piece of territory. Of course, his recent comments have also been followed by a less than auspicious visit to the island by Vice President J.D. Vance. So what do Greenlanders make of all of this, and what is sentiment like and public opinion in the territory? Let's find out now when I'm joined by Gustav Agnemann, who is an Associate Professor, Department of Economics at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. You're welcome to Taking Stock, Gustav.
Very nice to be here.
Great. Now, listen, you've been tracking public opinion in Greenland for quite a few years. Before we get into any of that, though, for our own listeners' benefit, can you just sort of take us through how exactly is Greenland currently governed, and what is its structure?
So it's a self-governed territory. They have their own parliament. They have a government, but they don't run their own, say, foreign policies, for instance. And Greenland has the ability to take home more responsibilities. But it comes down to economics. But the one thing they can't take home is foreign policy. It's governed by, or that's that takes place in Copenhagen.
Okay, so they have their own local parliament and so on. They can talk about local economic issues, roads, all that sort of stuff, infrastructure. But when it comes to, say, defence, foreign policy, that remains and is retained by Denmark. Would that be a fair summary?
That's correct, yes.
Now, a lot of us who are coming to this story for the first time, really, hasn't been maybe on a lot of people's radars, at least in this part of the world. I suppose we're told or we're presented as a fait accompli that Denmark, you know, and Greenland, you know, a lot of Greenlanders feel, or we're told that they feel, that Denmark has not done a good job being sort of the overseer of the territory. Where does that come from? Or can you help us to pinpoint why do a lot of Greenlanders feel that way?
Well, it is true that many Greenlanders feel some negative sentiment towards Denmark. I'd say that there are multiple reasons for that. Most, you know, are based on the colonial legacy of Denmark in Greenland. And many Greenlanders still today feel that there's a colonial relation between the two. At the same time, Denmark has, they have a yearly transfer to Greenland. So they do support the Greenlandic welfare state, which is 50% funded directly from Denmark. Greenlanders and Danes have close relations. They often, Greenlanders spend time in Denmark during their education. They often work in Denmark. But there's a sense of, the two territories are far apart in terms of physical distance, also in culture. So they're just very different. And many Greenlanders, for that reason, want independence.
Now, as you say, independence is one option. I suppose there are three options. One is to just go entirely independent and maybe have relations with various countries. They can retain their current constitutional relationship with Denmark. And then, of course, there's the wild card in the pack, the possibility of becoming part of the United States. Can you give us some idea of, you know, those three options, where the public in Greenland are on those, or who supports what, or what, how are they all viewed, those three particular maybe roads into the future for the country?
Well, I'd say the wild card is it's not very talked about up until Donald Trump brought it up. Greenlanders there's not really any movement toward joining the United States in Greenland. It hasn't been historically, and certainly isn't at this point in time. As for becoming independent or gaining more independence or remaining part of the Danish kingdom, opinions are split. Most Greenlanders want independence at some point, but the timing of independence, opinions regarding that varies considerably within Greenland.
And do you think, as an academic watching this, by opening up the whole independence issue anyway, and I understand why people would want to do that, but it opens a Pandora's box where it allows other countries, most leadingly the United States, to, I suppose, see this country as in play, you know, strategically it's now up for grabs, whether that's the case or not. So are Greenlanders nervous about, even by discussing independence, it opens all sorts of forces that they may not be able to control?
Many are, in some respects, happy that the independence is brought, you know, to the forefront of the agenda. But at the same time, yes, there are worries that Greenland has a population of 55,000. And of course, they know that they couldn't stand any foreign aggression. So whenever they're talked about in the United States or in Russia or China, that comes with some anxiety for some Greenlanders, at least. And I'd say they are happy to discuss independence, but at the same time, those who are negatively inclined toward independence, or at least want it gradual, they're afraid that foreign influence may also affect the information landscape in Greenland. So the fact that independence is talked about to a large extent also means that different types of information are spreading, and they're not always truthful.
Now that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, because you've actually gone out and done survey data directly in different parts of Greenland with research teams and so on, and surveyed the public opinion directly. But then you do hear people like J.D. Vance, President Trump, saying, this is what Greenlanders want to do, this is how they feel, this is what they think. It must be frustrating for you, who's done the actual research, to hear some of it at least being misrepresented.
Absolutely, it was misrepresented, especially with, you know, respect to, we went there in 2018, not thinking about too much the relations between Greenland and the US, because they weren't topical at that point in time. The underlying idea when J.D. Vance and Trump talks about that Greenlanders want to be independent is that, well, they want to be independent and then join us. But if you ask Greenlanders themselves, I think it was only 5% in a recent survey that responded, yes, that's a viable option. That's something we would like to do. So when we went there in 2018 and recovered a representative sample of the Greenlandic population, we found that, well, opinions were more or less split between independence and remaining part of the Danish territory, at least for or the Danish kingdom, at least for some time. The United States didn't have anything to do with the survey questions we asked, and they also weren't part of, you know, what Greenlanders themselves had in mind when they think about future options.
Well, it sounds like you might want to organize another trip to get the latest survey data. It might be quite fruitful. I know this is not your direct area, but you might be able to help us nevertheless, being in a Department of Economics. But do you have any sense of, we hear this constant talk about the mineral wealth that Greenland possesses, but it's never really spelled out, or, you know, we don't hear much talk about how, whether it would be easily obtainable or what kind of minerals are there or anything. Can you give us any sense of, do you know much about what could be there or what the big attraction is? I'd just like to see it, maybe that whole point fleshed out a bit by somebody at one stage.
So Greenland is rich in minerals, and there are potential hydrocarbon, well, there are hydrocarbon deposits, but whether or not they're commercial or not is uncertain. But definitely with climate change and global warming, these minerals that are hidden under ice at this point in time, well, they will be cheaper to mine. And for that reason, Greenland is projected to become a frontier for mining companies in the future. At this point in time, though, it's been, you know, they do try to attract foreign investments, but it has been difficult for Greenland for different reasons. One is environmental regulations. They are very keen to preserve the nature of this pristine landscape, and so they don't want to cause any issues in that respect. At the same time, mining is expensive in Greenland, just as searching for minerals or searching for oil deposits are also expensive. So it's not obvious that there will be a spike in investments in the next few years. But over time, gradually, Greenland will probably attract more and more. Sure.
Let me be a little bit blunt on this, but I mean, looking at the population figures, I'm seeing about 56,000 people, being slightly increasing, but not hugely. I mean, if you brought in a few mineral companies, a few extraction companies, resource companies, I mean, even if you had two or three of those companies, there's probably going to be about 50,000 workers coming with them at various times. It would almost swamp the local population and change the entire makeup of the place. So, I mean, it's not just a question of extracting these minerals. It would change Greenland forever in many very profound ways.
Absolutely. And that's something that's been on the table before, where they, for instance, had an aluminium processing company that wanted to establish and then would have brought thousands of workers to Greenland. And of course, that's a worry. That's something that they also consider. And Greenlandic politicians are very sort of keen on thinking about how could this benefit our country? How can, you know, what would be optimal taxes? What would be a way to make companies hire Greenlandic workers? And of course, that's the main issue for them. That's what they have in mind when they think about foreign investments.
Now, the relationship with the US, this has to be our last question because we're just a bit out of time, but the US has a base there, has a military base there. It has been run down in terms of numbers and so on. There was a huge amount of US soldiers there during the Cold War, but it has come back since then. But whether Greenlanders like it, whether Denmark likes it, whether any of us like it, the relationship with the US is going to continue. That base is still going to be there and possibly going to get larger. So even if the Trump administration wraps up and maybe another party, Democrats, return to power in Washington, the relationship with the US will still become important. It's not going to go away.
That's absolutely true. And that's why many have been so confused by Trump's statements, because, well, NATO and by extension, the US has a presence and the US has a direct presence in Greenland. So they don't really need to acquire Greenland in order to defend it. They are obliged to defend it. And they have a military base there, as you say.
Well, as you say yourself, we're going to be talking about Greenland for several years, whoever the occupant is of the White House, because of that strategic importance it has. For the moment, we've started the debate and started looking at it, and we'll be probably talking to you again, Gustav Angelman, who is an associate professor at the Department of Economics at Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Thank you for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thank you very much.
This is Emmett Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we get under the skin of sovereign wealth funds. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I am Emmett Oliver. Now, listeners, when you hear the phrase sovereign wealth fund, what is your instant reaction, if any? Lots of us would say, oh, they sound nice, they're full of money and we have control over them and they can do things. And they're a sign of success, I suppose, national success. We're trying to build two of them up in Ireland at the moment. There's already several billion gone into them. But of course, those of a sporting mindset might also think of LIV Golf, where you've seen some money going in from Saudi Arabia. And of course, Newcastle Football Club as well, both backed by Saudi PIF. Sovereign wealth funds, I think it's fair to say, are having a bit of a moment. But are they actually as good as their promoters would tell us? The latest one being getting some scrutiny is Indonesia's Danantara Fund, which has assets of $900 billion so far, and it's ready to invest it at home and abroad. Closer to home, the UK government has also great plans for its own national wealth fund. So do these types of accumulations of money really work, and should they be an important part of different countries and what they do on the international stage? Joining me now to discuss all of this is Robin Harding, who is Asia editor of the Financial Times. You're welcome to Taking Stock, Robin.
There.
Listen, as I said, sovereign health funds, I've described them as having a bit of a moment. They seem to be cropping up all over the place. We know the larger ones like Norway, of course, Saudi Arabia catches a lot of people's eye because of the sheer scale of what's available there. It seems you're not a sort of self-respecting, proud nation if you don't have a sovereign wealth fund. But you've been sort of poking around and maybe just asking a few questions. So where does your interest in them come from, and where are your critical points arising from?
Yeah, well, so I've been inspired to look at this by this new sovereign wealth fund in Indonesia, which is called Danantara. And basically what they've done there is they've got $900 billion worth of existing state assets. It's like the National Oil Company and the National Telecom Company. And they've shoved it in this thing called Danantara and said, wow, now we have a $900 billion sovereign wealth fund. Isn't that great? The problem here is when you took $900 billion out of one pocket and you put it into this thing called the sovereign wealth fund, just doing that has not made you wealthier. The question is, can this thing now reinvest the money in a way that's going to make a bigger profit than if you just used the money in the normal way? So you built roads, you built hospitals, you built whatever else you need. And I think that's the thing with sovereign wealth funds. Like you said, everyone feels like they need to have one, but just feeling like you need to have one is not necessarily a good reason to have one.
Now, Robin, taking your Indonesian example, and just let's look through that prism for a second. The argument for them is they are a rainy day fund. They're sort of windfall gains put away, and they take it away from the politicians and even the civil servants and put it over to the side where the daily pressures don't come on it. It's sort of a long-term strategic planning is the sort of justification for them. Looking at the Indonesian example, does that hold water, or are you not convinced?
Well, I think there's two problems with that. One is, if it is a rainy day fund, then sure. If it's, you know, Saudi Arabia's oil money and you're saving it up for the future, then no problem at all. Yeah, you need to put that in some sort of fund. But in the Indonesian case, that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening in the UK. It's not what's happening in the US, where they're talking about one as well. There, they're just saying, well, we want a fund. So we're going to stuff some existing money into it and say, well, now we have a fund. So that's problem one. Second problem, you say, well, it's taking it away from the politicians. Okay, maybe. Or maybe it's taking it from the budget and putting it into something less scrutinized where the politicians can do what they want with it. And there's the infamous case in Malaysia of this fund called 1MDB, about which a famous book, Billion Dollar Whale, was written, where basically, yes, they put it in a sovereign wealth fund, and then all sorts of people put their hands in the pot and stole the money. So if you can govern it well, maybe it's a rainy day fund, or maybe it's a slush fund. So just calling it a sovereign wealth fund, I don't think solves that problem.
And do you think, Robin, that the key thing here is the governance over these funds, you know, those behind them, those who have controlled the mandate of the fund? Is, so in other words, if your governance is good, this is a good idea. If your governance is bad to start with, it's a bad idea.
I think obviously your governance has got to be good, but for something else, there's got to be a purpose for doing it. Why are you doing this? If you have a load of money, like oil money, and you need to look after it, I get it. Sovereign wealth fund makes sense. But if you don't have this pile of assets sitting there that, you know, you need to do something with, and you're creating it because you think, well, just by creating a sovereign wealth fund, we can do something good for ourselves, that I'm really not convinced.
Yeah, I suppose it comes down to those who are making the decisions. Obviously, a lot of this is trying to grow the money. You've got to get a return. You can see in the Norwegian fund, the way they operate, they're very savvy, astute investors, and they have a big influence over financial markets. So the quality of the people behind it, their investment decisions, the rules that they have to be operate under, I suppose all of that is absolutely crucial. But as you say, when there's a lot of money, it could go wrong as it can go right, and people can get maybe out of control and sort of maybe start believing their own publicity.
Yeah, totally. There's a big risk of that. But you know, there's a real conundrum here because, you know, say the state, the Irish state, the British state, whichever state, you know, you've got a euro, a dollar, a pound. You can invest it in financial assets and try and get a return, or you can invest it in building a road and maybe you grow the economy. So why it's a good idea to put it in financial assets, that's the bit that's just still a bit mysterious to me.
Yeah, I suppose that if it's not to go into the, I'm just being a devil's advocate, which is my job here, but if it's not to go into a sovereign wealth fund, well, then where does it go? Then it goes back into central government, where it's either going to become capital spending in the normal manner, or it's going to actually get siphoned into current spending. I suppose the idea of them originally, and I suppose some of them aren't very old, you know, they've only been around a few years, maybe a decade or so, but the idea of their original conception was, look, you know, if you have it separate and it's governed separately, when things get bad, it won't be raided like a piggy bank by the politicians who have maybe a budget deficit or something like that to sort of sort out. So it's that hermetically sealed idea that you take the temptation away from the daily politicians and the managers of the economy. Does that make any sense to you, or does that? It doesn't sound like it does.
It does make a lot of sense to me. But it makes sense to me if you have this situation where you have long-term money. So there are several situations that make sense. Long-term oil money makes sense. If it's a pension fund, so Japan has a huge fund called the Government Pension Investment Fund, which is basically assets that are set aside for pensions, makes total sense to me. China has huge funds. They're basically, it's foreign exchange reserves, which are money that they accumulated over for many years when their currency was cheap. So in those situations, you've built up money for a reason. And yes, you really do need to set it aside and keep it safe from being raided by the politicians for the daily budget. But the situation I don't get is when you're creating it because you want to have money. Okay, so you want to save and you create a piggy bank. I guess it sort of makes sense, but the real problem is for saving the money. It's not creating the piggy bank to put it in. And I think what's going on is a lot of people feel like they would like to have a piggy bank with a lot of money in. And so they're doing what, you know, you or I or our kids might do. They're going out and buying the piggy bank, which is making the sovereign wealth fund. But now they've got to do the difficult bit, which is actually save the money to put in the sovereign wealth fund. And to me, that's where the whole thing kind of breaks down a bit.
Yeah, and I suppose, as you say, you know, which comes first, you know? And is there a national ego at work here where, you know, if the country beside you has to have one, well, we got to have one too. We found here in Ireland that we had a national pension reserve fund, and as soon as the great financial crisis came in 2008, that had to be brought back into play because it was needed to shore up the banks who got into trouble over property lending. We won't go on into all of that now because it would require a separate program, but all of that money got flushed back into the system. So when desperation comes on the politicians and there is a financial crisis, they'll go and get this money anyway. So I suppose the sovereign wealth fund, certainly in other countries, maybe Norway because of the sheer scale of it, is a different thing. But for those of us who are in smaller economies, less powerful ones and less rich, they will come and get that money anyway if they need it.
I think that's right. To me, it comes down to, do you have a reason to save the money? And Ireland, you know, you may well have a good reason to do it because, for example, you've had these very big tax money like Apple. I don't know the details, but if you've got money and you don't think it's going to come in every year and you want to spread it over time, then I think that's another time when these sovereign wealth funds really do make sense, or we put it away for a rainy day. But the UK, you know, the UK government is completely cash trapped. Mm. The idea that they've got money to put in a sovereign wealth fund is a bit far-fetched, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that really is ego. They feel like they want to have one. They feel like it's a good thing to boast about. So they make this thing, but it doesn't make the money to put in it.
No. The other, I suppose, of course, worry is patronage. So as you say, yes, there'll be very kind of respected faces and names put on the board of the Sovereign Wealth Fund. There'll be people there who are seen as very wise and know about investment and are very astute and may have a very good investment track record. But ultimately, they're under the control or certainly influence of the political classes. So that's where you see your Saudis, you know, the sports washing or whatever. So there is that worry about the political influence. Some of them will be run very soberly and very prudently and just be simply there to make a return. Others will be looking to, I suppose, be an extension of the state and fulfill its objectives, whether it's buying football clubs or investing in golf tournaments. So there is a worry, and I don't know whether this in Asia in particular this is relevant, but there is a worry that it becomes a form of sort of national patronage where money is just shelled out onto projects that the political classes want to put money into overseas, and maybe it's a form of diplomacy, I suppose, a financial diplomacy. Is that another worry, particularly in Asia, where a lot of them have autocratic backgrounds, some of the countries?
Well, certainly. So I think in Indonesia, it's really interesting. They've recruited a really high profile bunch of international people to be on the advisory board of this thing, Danantara, including Ray Dalio, who's the founder of Bridgewater, which is one of the world's biggest hedge funds. They've got Thaksin Shinawatra, the former prime minister of Thailand. So they've got all of these people to try and sort of guarantee that the governance of this thing will be good. But there is this example of one MDB in Malaysia where the governance was bad and it was used for exactly those reasons. It wasn't just used for patronage. It was used for elections. It was frankly just used to have big parties with Hollywood stars. And that's always a risk. You know, you put a huge amount of money in an account and you let a few people run the account. There's always a risk they're going to do bad things with it.
Yeah, and of course, Thaksin Shinawatra, I remember him from his foray into football, right? Purchase of Absolutely. Manchester City a good few years ago now, right?
Exactly. So, you know, you have all these big people, big egos, they want to do big things, and sometimes they do good big things, which are really constructive and help the nation. And sometimes they go off on vanity projects and sports teams and live at golf and all the rest of it.
All right. Well, listen, you've given us a good corrective to maybe some of the hysteria around all of this. Before you go, I just want to ask you about what's been happening in Asia markets over the last few days. We've obviously had the U-turn, or sort of partial U-turn by Donald Trump from the tariffs under pressure, unrelenting pressure from the bond market, exacting a price even on him. But how have the Asian markets been reacting to this? Obviously, China is in a very fearsome, belligerent mood, but other countries trying to make an accommodation with the US. You see that in the case of Japan and Vietnam to some degree as well. So can you just draw us a picture of how the sort of contrary reactions have been going?
Well, it's been chaos everywhere, here as well, markets gyrating up and down and up and down. What we've seen today, where Donald Trump has just rolled back the tariffs on everywhere except for China, is it's really split. So Japan, Taiwan, Korea, some of those other markets really bounced back strongly, but the China market didn't bounce back nearly as much. So it's becoming clear that China is really going to be the big loser from these tariffs. China's in a fighting mood. I would not count out the Chinese. Their economy is quite remarkable. But yeah, that's the state of play right now.
And there has been some talk about like kind of a circle of people in Asia cooperating against the US, like South Korea and so on. But we haven't really seen much of that. It seems to be, is it fair to describe as China standing alone at the moment, or do they have allies around them as well?
They don't have allies exactly. I mean, everyone is in the same boat with dealing with the US tariffs. No one likes it, but everyone's scared of China as well. I mean, they're scared of China's economic strength. They're scared of China's political power. And so people aren't really willing to team up with China on this. I think the mood is more, well, if Donald Trump wants to go after China, thank God, let him do that, and maybe he'll leave us alone. It's more that sort of sense rather than solidarity amongst Asian countries at the moment.
All right. Well, that might be the sensible way to go based on what we've seen in the last few months. For the moment, thank you for updating us on that. Robin Harding is Asia editor of the Financial Times. Appreciate you joining us and taking stock, Robin.
Lovely. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast first thing on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. On research this week was Stephen Daunt, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening, and of course, enjoy the rest of your day.